produced by Jeffrey Grisellius, Joseph Cottrell and Ken Fuller. This is Yes Music Podcast episode 601, the Yes Album Listening Guides, Tales from Topographic Oceans, Part 5, Steve Howe's Guitars.
Hi, this is Trevor Rabin and you're listening to the Yes Podcast.
Welcome to episode 601 of the Yes Music Podcast, two fans' exploration of the world's greatest progressive rock band. I'm your host, Kevin Mulrine, and co-host Mark Anthony Kay will be along in just a few moments. You can always get involved with the podcast yourself via the various different ways on the site, yesmusicpodcast.com. This week, Mark and I returned to Tales from Topographic Oceans to consider Steve Howe's guitars, based on Mark's expert knowledge and thanks to Jeff Bailey, who kindly sent us photos of the Steve Howe Guitar Collection book. After recording, I also heard from Nick Kokosius that he has assembled a set of photos on Facebook all about the guitars on Tales. So please see the link in the show notes for this episode to see what he has found out. You may need to join the Facebook group to view the photos. Thank you so much to all listeners who have donated to our charity appeal already. After only a week, we have reached 81% of our target, which is amazing. If you possibly can, please click on the link on yesmusicpodcast.com and help us to raise at least £600 to celebrate 600 episodes of the YMP by supporting Prostate Cancer UK. On the YMP Facebook discussion group this week, Doug Curran added the following: an interview with Trevor Rabin by Classic Album Review about his new album Rio. A happy birthday to current Kansas keyboardist and former Yes Live keyboardist Tom Brislin. Oliver Waitman's latest newsletter, including the completion of his new album. A jazzy version of Roundabout by trumpeter-composer Don Ellis from 1972. And he must have been quick off the mark with that cover version. A photo from Progstock in New Jersey of Patrick Mraz with Dave Bainbridge and Sally Minear. A happy 23rd anniversary to the House of Yes Live from House of Blues CDs. And his copy of Trevor Rabin's new album, Rio. For his part, Jeffrey Mason contributed the following: a photo of Bill Bruford with Genesis in New York in 1976, an article about the fabled Birotron, great photos from Wembley 1978 by Ross Halfin, an interview with Trevor Rabin from the Italian Rolling Stone, Rick Wakeman unveiling a train called Radio Caroline in Essex, UK, the original band photo stickers that came with the programme for Yes concerts in 1973, and photos from Montreal Forum on the Tales Tour and San Diego Sports Arena in March 1974. Billy Sherwood showed off his Machine Messiah chops, and Steve Rhode shared another Trevor Rabin interview, this time from the Daily Doug. Here's a spoiler alert, skip forward 15 seconds if you don't want to hear it. Because Ken Fuller isn't keen on the current Tales medley being played by the band at the moment, and Miguel Falcao posted a photo of himself relaxing after a concert on his current tour, listening to episode 600 of the YMP. So thank you very much indeed to everyone who's been in touch in any way this week, including the commenters on last week's show notes: Doug Curran, Paul Tomei, Dave Watkinson, Jeffrey Grisellius, Tim Stannard, Mike O'Connor, and Guy Jerome.
Yes Music Podcast, 12 True Summers.
Brilliant to be back talking about Tales from Topographic Oceans again. This is the Yes Album Listening Guide, Part 5. And today, Mark and I are going to talk about Steve Howe's guitars. Hello, Mark.
Hello, Kevin. How are you doing today?
I'm doing very well. Yourself?
Not too bad. We're enjoying autumn weather here in full flight. Everything is now like 8 degrees Celsius now. No more warm weather. Lots of colored leaves falling everywhere. It's very autumn here.
Sounds like perfect conditions to listen to Tales from Topographic Oceans to me, as all conditions are, perhaps. All right. So Henderson and Howe, they were the main architects of Tales, as we've discovered previously. So I suppose what guitars Howe chooses would be very important to the overall sound. So what do you think of the overall sound, Mark, of the guitars on Tales, before we dig into each one in turn? And do you think this is significantly different to his guitar sounds on previous albums?
That's sort of a yes and no. I would describe the guitars on this album as sort of experimental in a lot of ways. Mm. After doing a lot of the research here about these guitars, because, you know, guitar is my forte. Mm. I mean, people wouldn't think, you know, that I'd be talking about marimba or something. You know, guitars are my area of expertise.
Yes.
So there is a sort of consistency, but then there's not, because he does use one guitar in particular, which we'll get to on a previous album that he uses on this one. But on Topographic Oceans, he seems to have decided to really experiment and broaden his palette as far as using different guitars for different sounds and for different textures and color and stuff like that. So if you're a guitar player and you like hearing different tones and stuff like that, then this is the album for you, for sure.
Excellent. Okay, well, I was quite surprised, and we need to thank Jeff Bailey, who sent me all sorts of photographs of the Steve Howe guitar collection book, which I still haven't managed to get myself a copy of. It's really quite expensive nowadays. So Jeff very kindly sent me the photographs, all the ones to do with Tales. Well, and we'll see if we do cover all the guitars that you know are on Tales, Mark. But the first one is the main guitar. So this is what Steve Howe actually identifies as the main guitar of Tales, and it's the Les Paul Jr. Now, I didn't know an awful lot about this. I know quite a bit now from writing the book about Tormato, about other Les Paul guitars that Steve Howe used, about the Les Paul itself and the Les Paul Special. But this Les Paul Jr., and I was very surprised to read that this is actually quite a cheap instrument, isn't it? It's not top-of-the-range stuff.
Okay, I find it's always humorous when people bring this up that it's a cheap guitar. When it first came out, it was introduced as a guitar for students.
Right.
This guitar. It was very affordable. It's basically just a slab of mahogany with a neck attached to it. Yeah. One dog ear P90 pickup, you know, and that's it. A very simple wraparound tail bridge, you know. Even that is like very like simplistic, very primitive even. Mm. You know, it's just one piece where you put the string in one way, wrap the string around the metal and reattach it the other side to the tone tuning peg.
Oh, right. Yes.
I mean, there's no actual separate saddles or nothing, which makes it difficult to intonate, which is something that Steve Howe didn't like about this guitar, and we'll get into that a little bit after. But yeah, it is considered the low end of the spectrum. But with that said, now, to buy a brand new Gibson Les Paul Jr. in the store, you're looking at least like $1,400 to $1,500 Canadian. So to say it's a cheap introductory guitar is, you know, maybe cheap in the line of Gibsons, but, you know, it's definitely not a cheap guitar by any stretch of the imagination. And lots of well-known guitar players use and collect these. And if you happen to be able to get your hands on a, you know, 55 or 56 Junior, then that's a lot of money for those.
Yeah. Okay, so you mentioned there a couple of the things which make it more basic than some other models, particularly of Les Pauls themselves. And I know that the Les Paul Special has two pickups, for example, where the Les Paul Junior has one. So what does that give you, and what does that not give you if you've only got one pickup on an electric guitar?
Well, basically, when you have one pickup, you're limited to the amount of tones that you can get. Now, the thing is, the people who love this guitar will always kind of argue and say, no, with this, because there are some real lovers and appreciators of this guitar, let me tell you.
Mm.
And there are people that are out there that are saying that as long as you have a working volume knob and tone knob on this guitar, you can get a whole world of different tones by turning down the volume, turning down the tone, or turning up the tone, and turn, you know, all these different combinations of the controls can give you different tones. And it is true to an extent, you know, because the P90 pickup that's in there is pretty hot, right? And it's pretty, it can get you a lot of tones at a loud volume, like really aggressive tones.
Yeah.
And then if you turn it down, you can clean it up a bit more. And so there's a lot you can still do with the one pickup. But obviously, if you have two, now you can get a whole world of different things by combining the two, just using the front, just using the back. You know, then there's a whole new world of tones that are available.
Just explain to those of us who are not quite clear what hot means when you're talking about pickups.
Well, hot means like it will distort easier, like through an amp. Like if you turn this the pickup like on 10,
right?
And if you plug into an amplifier, then the amount of gain that you need to put onto the amplifier for it to start distort will be less you would need with this guitar than, let's say, another guitar that had like a lower hotness in pickup, right? Because you'll see a lot of times when people are doing these like guitar shows, like Troglies, for example, that guy who had the guitar there, he always does a pickup reading. He'll go, oh, the back pickup reads at 8.7, you know, whatever. I forget what the rating is, if it's an ohmage or whatever it is. I'm not too familiar with that term, but whatever that is, he always reads them out. So if it's like an 11.6, that's a really like hot pickup, whereas you'll get something that's like 7.7, which is like a usual, like a regular Les Paul reads around there, right? Which means that if you want to get it to really start getting distorted and breaking up, then you'll probably have to add more distortion or have to add a pedal or something to make it that way. But with this pickup in particular, you don't have to do nearly as much because it already has so much power within it that you don't need to do as much to make it that way.
Okay, well, I'm slightly confused now because I wouldn't have expected in that case, Steve Howe, to have chosen this guitar because, as we've discussed many times, he loves a clean tone and doesn't want distortion. So clearly this guitar is adaptable enough to give him what he needs on Tails?
Absolutely. I mean, and that's the thing that he also mentions, though, about this in here, is that he does say that this guitar is one of those guitars that it was hard. So here it is. Of course, it was hard for the guitar to cope with some of the things I wanted to play. I don't think all of it sounds sweet. Looking back, I probably would have chosen different guitars more often, but at the time, I stuck with it for continuity and simplicity.
Fascinating. So clearly he was looking for that. He was looking for some continuity, some sounds that were consistent across all four sides. And he does say that this Les Paul Junior he used on most of sides 2, 3, and 4, and especially side 4 Ritual. So we can all think of in our heads some of those tones that he gets out of this guitar on Ritual. But yes, fascinating to hear that in fact, in retrospect, he might have chosen different guitars to get different effects. So what do you think of this choice then? Can you imagine yourself ever choosing one guitar or specifically this guitar to play the music you want to play?
The funny thing is I love the look of this guitar. Every time I've seen it, like, I really love how this guitar looks. And at my local music store, I saw the other day, like when I went more recently, actually, I was like, oh, they have a Junior. Exactly the one that we see in the book here, like the TV yellow one. They even had a tobacco burst one as well. So I went to the store, grabbed it, ran over to the corner where they had the amplifiers, grabbed a patch cord, plugged it in, and I hated it. I couldn't stand it. I don't know. I was so disappointed because I wanted to love it. You know what I mean? But I don't like the sound of the P90 pickup in it. It just sounds a little too... It does sound aggressive. Like, it does have, like, that little bit of bite to it that I was talking about.
Yeah.
But it also has a little bit of this in there that I don't like as well. Ah. It's a little dull in spots.
Yes.
But, it all depends on what you want it for. Because when I think of the Junior, I just think of that part on the guitar that Steve does before it comes back in with the acoustic guitar. But when John comes back... that little line in between all that stuff that he does on the guitar, that's total Les Paul Junior.
Right.
All that stuff. And when you listen to it on that album, especially side 4, very like distorted, not like distorted, but it's like it has much more crunch to it than his normal sound for sure. Right?
Yeah.
And I've always said that if you want to hear what a Junior sounds like with Yes, just put on The Ritual. That's the song you want to hear.
Yeah, absolutely. And so when we're talking about his normal sound, his usual sound, then perhaps we're talking about the Gibson ES-175, and we'll talk about models which are similar to that in a moment. But clearly, it's still very much Steve Howe when you listen to Tales. You're not thinking, oh, he's radically changed his approach here. As perhaps you're thinking a bit more on something like Relayer, where he used the Telecaster more. So is this a dramatic change from Close to the Edge for you, or is it still very much Steve doing his thing, but just with a slightly different sounding guitar?
Yeah, I mean, Steve Howe is Steve Howe. You can give him Eddie Van Halen's guitar, and it's going to sound like Steve Howe still, yeah, because it's the way he plays. It's in his hands. It's his technique. It's the way he picks. It's the way he, you know, sometimes when he picks, he uses a pick and his fingers at the same, you know, it's very much Steve Howe. His technique is what makes the sound. And, mm-hmm, and you know, like when he, and that's the thing, if he was to take, let's say, Eddie Van Halen's guitar and put it into his amplifier, it would not sound how Eddie would, because he wouldn't set up his amp the same way as Eddie Van Halen would. Mm. That's another thing as well. An amplifier has a lot to do with the sound as well, right?
Mm.
Not just the guitars. And when I listen back to other Steve Howe stuff, like side one of this record is very familiar ground as far as sound, because the guitar that he uses on side one is the same guitar he used for Close to the Edge.
Yeah.
So, which is the Gibson 345.
Yes. All
right. So that right there, and that might have been a very smart move on his part as well,
mm-hmm,
to have done that, because Yes fans, when they heard that first song, they might not have been like, what is this completely odd sound? Because we started getting that as the album continues, right? And and he kind of leads us into Comfortable Waters on the first song, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so let's get into that Gibson then. So the Gibson, which most people identify with Steve Howe, is his Gibson ES-175. It's his, mm-hmm, main guitar, you could say.
Yeah.
But he also had these Gibson ES-345 models. And, mm-hmm, the one that I've seen him play in concert, and the one that he uses on Tales, is the dark brown one, isn't it?
Yes.
So that's to give it its full name, Gibson ES-345 TD, I think. And so why do you think he went for that one over the ES-175, which he had used so extensively in the past?
Well, I think the answer might be partially in the name of the guitar.
Right.
Because when you say ES, which is electric Spanish, right?
All right.
345 is just like the model number.
Yeah.
And T means thin line, right?
Ah, right.
And the D means double pickup.
Uh-huh. Right? Right.
So, as we all know, the Gibson 175 is that thing is a boat. Okay, it's so thick. If you put it on water, you could probably take two kids on there and float down the river with it, no problem. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
But this thing is considerably thinner, right?
Right.
It has a double pickup, just like his 175 does. But it also has something that his other guitar does not have, and that it has a baritone switch, which is one of these little, I think they call it a bird nose or bird head switch, one of those little switches, the rotary switches.
Yeah.
That gives you five different settings. And he's said a few times that he doesn't really use it too much. He only uses two of the five settings
right
on there.
Okay.
But that also gives it a sort of difference in tone. And the main thing with the 345, the big, big, big thing, which is the reason why he loves it, is because it's a stereo guitar. And
right,
what he likes to do is puts one side of the signal to one amplifier and sets it, you know, maybe a little bit dirtier and a little bit more crunchier.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other side of it goes to a clean amplifier where he puts some digital delay on it. And when you play it together, it's like this big stereo sound that he absolutely loves.
Right. Now, that reminds me of Chris Squire, because his Rickenbacker wasn't originally, I don't think, a stereo bass guitar, but he wired it so that it would be a stereo. So this is something that clearly Yes musicians are very much into, making this stereo effect. And of course, always I think about the rotating stage, but normally, and certainly on the Tales tour, they were on a standard stage, a flat stage as it were, with speakers on either side. So is that what he did? He actually fed slightly different signal from this guitar to those two different sides of the stage?
Well, yeah, I mean, but from what I've seen before, and I could be wrong about this, but whenever I see Steve Howe's guitar setup, behind him, he always has two amps on a tilt facing up behind him,
right?
So that's probably the two amps that he uses. Now, whether or not he has another set of amps on the other side, I don't know. I've never really seen him do that, because I know that he's always been a two-amp guy, right? But that's how he sets up his tone normally. He has two amps behind him. He sends one, you know, with this signal, one with the other. But more recent now, if you watch him now, he uses one amplifier. He was big on that Line 6 Bogner series amp that he was using. And that's very possible that that's a stereo amplifier as well, right? Yeah. Like two speakers in there, two 12 speakers. And he just now sets it up with his Line 6 pedal board stuff. And he has it all set up for stereo and this, that. So he doesn't really need to use the stereo stuff from the guitar anymore. Don't forget, we're talking about 1974. The technology he's using now, if you would have told him that in 74 that he would be doing that, he'd laugh in your face. Yeah, you know?
Absolutely. So just for me, because I'm really don't understand this stuff, and you do and have done it many times, but in the recording studio, for example, so he would have those two speakers, two amplifiers, both with slightly different things. So would they would be what, mic'd up differently? And I'm just wondering what happened to that stereo signal when it gets as far as the recording board. Is it split there or?
Well, usually what you would do is one or two things. He would set it up like he does live with the two amps, and they would put one microphone in front of one amp, one microphone in front of the other. They would most likely separate the amps far away from each other. They wouldn't be so close like they are on stage.
Okay.
Right, because you want to separate to get as much definition from each amp as possible, right? Mm, mm. So you'd separate them as far as possible, mic them, and he would play. Now, another technique that people do and do more often is they record one sound at a time. They'll do the dirty one first, record it with one amp, then they'll go back, rewind, start at the top, record the second guitar with the other sound. Now, the only disadvantage of that is that if he's hoping to do the same thing that he played the first time, you have to have good memory and playing it exactly the same way again, which is usually the reason why sometimes people do it this way, where they have the two amps and play them at once and record in stereo. So they don't have they only have to play it once, right?
Yeah, fascinating. And I suppose that's one of the things that, just imagining Steve, you know, playing his parts and then going into the control room to make sure that those two stereo signals are balanced properly in the mixing and so on.
Well, that's the great thing about being in a recording studio, because when you record it, even if he goes in and says, I think the clean guitar isn't loud enough, they just have to go, whoop, move the fader up a bit, and then it's balanced. So, you know, you don't have that luxury maybe as much live, but at live, you know, Steve always had his stuff figured out pretty well, I think, and always had it kind of set up to his likings. I can't imagine Steve however going on stage with having his amplifiers not set up the way he likes.
Yeah.
You know, heads would roll, I would think.
Yes, I would imagine so. So it's fascinating this. So yes, there's that big connection between the two records, Close to the Edge to Tails. We've got this Gibson 345, yes, 345 TD on both. And that's a bit strange to think, because if you associate the 175 with Steve so much, and to realize that two of the most iconic albums of Yes, Close to the Edge and Tails, really, it's that dark brown one. It's the other guitar. So absolutely fascinating. And does he always live, you know, play the correct parts on the correct guitar? So does he ever switch into the 175 to play some of the bits that he actually recorded with the other guitar?
I've never really seen him do that. I can only imagine that would happen if, let's say, he played the 345 and he broke a string or something and he had to quickly switch guitars. Maybe they would give him the 175. Then you got to also remember one thing too, Kevin. The 175, I believe, only had 20 frets on the neck, whereas the 345 had 22. So, and it was also a lot easier to go up to the higher notes on a 345 than it is on a 175. Right. So that's another big thing as well, because especially if you're writing guitar solos where he's far up the neck, you wouldn't want to go back and use a 175 and then you're in trouble. Like, oh, I don't have enough notes here to do what I did. Right. He could, of course, improvise it, I'm sure, right?
Yes.
But if you wanted to do it exactly the same way, that would be an issue too, right?
Okay. Well, it's fascinating how he got hold of this guitar as well, because, as I've just said, the iconic Close to the Edge guitar and the start, at least, of Tails guitar, he got in payment for doing an advert. So this is a guitar which he didn't go out specifically and buy for himself, but he clearly loved it when he was given it for doing this advert for Gibson. So that was fortuitous, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the great things about getting endorsement deals or doing these kinds of things, is that, especially if you're a guitar player, if the company says to you, you know, your payment is a guitar, or your payment is something that they make, that's what you're almost hoping for, right?
Yeah, fantastic stuff. Okay, then. Well, let's move on from that iconic guitar to a different Gibson. Now, this is a fascinating little story, particularly as I've been looking into this Manticore place. Manticore place was an old cinema which was converted into recording studio space and rehearsal space by ELP. And Alan White claims that they spent 3 months in there rehearsing Tales. I don't think that's right. I think Steve's probably closer to the mark when he says that they spent a month practicing in this Manticore cinema, that as he calls it, with a different Gibson. Well, at least he took this different Gibson L5 CESN guitar.
Yeah,
another one to to conjure with, and he didn't end up using it at all. And went back to the ES-345 and the Les Paul Junior. So what's this Gibson guitar? What are the differences, and why do you think he didn't use it in the end?
Well, being a guitar player myself, there's right away when I see this guitar and having played one before, I know immediately why he didn't play it. Now, first of all, it's a beautiful looking guitar.
Yes.
It's like a piece of art made into guitar. Okay. Mm-hmm. The short term for this guitar is the Super 400. That's what they do. Whenever you hear a guitar collector saying, I got a Super 400, they're referring to this guitar. It's also known as an L5, right? And the whole thing with the lettering is that it's a CES, which is a cutaway electric Spanish, right?
Okay.
Now, again, the difference with this guitar than the ones that he was using or would use, for example, is that this is semi-hollow, this guitar.
Mm-hmm.
They have like openings, you know, those little cut-ins there that they have there.
Yep.
On there. Also, if you take a look at the neck, and I'm looking at a picture of one right now, this one only has 20 frets. Yeah, 20 frets. It's a very short length neck again.
Right.
And the access point to it, like it's for ease, you can only probably get up to 17 before you're still going to have start having some real trouble getting to the rest of the frets.
Right. Yeah.
And it's another thicker guitar. Again, like wider bodied.
Yeah.
And when I played it, I didn't like it at all. It was like, man, this was like, I felt like my hands were like 2 feet in front of me when I was picking, you know, it was like, but it's beautiful. It has ebony wood, abalone inlays. It's like it looks fantastic. And it's a very pricey guitar because it's beautifully handmade, these guitars.
Mm.
But he probably didn't want to use it, first of all, because at the volume that he played, and he said before that he doesn't play very loud, right?
No.
And it says here, I'll read a direct quote. He says, but it turned out that I began to find this guitar unusable for what I was doing, especially as it was prone to feedback at the levels I was playing at, which wasn't incredibly loud. So for topographic oceans, I went to the Gibson ES-345 again and the Les Paul Junior because they suited my purposes much better.
Mm. Fascinating. It is a lovely looking thing, and it's... The one in his book, the one he has, is a sort of it's a gold sort of starburst thing in the middle, and then out to red. It really is lovely looking thing.
It's a sunburst.
Sunburst. There you are. Thank you for the terminology. It does look great, but as you say, if it's difficult to play, and you know that's fascinating. I've never even thought of, you know, the shape of the guitar and the depth of the guitar making a difference to how you can play those highest notes. And know that Steve is all over the guitar, so I can see how that will have caused him problems.
Absolutely, because, you know, Steve, especially back in the day, was very hopscotchy over here. Like, just look at the beginning of Close to the Edge. He's like all over the neck, like from the first fret down to the 12th, back to the first. Like, he's going all over the place. And if you have a guitar where it's difficult to access some of these notes, that's not something that he would be interested in.
Absolutely. Okay, well, fascinating. He didn't end up using that. And that reminds me again of Tormato, where there were instruments that he tried out but didn't use in the end as well.
Sorry, there is one guitar, though, that we'd be foolish not to talk about really quickly.
Yeah.
And that is the 12-string Dan Electro that he used. Now, that 12-string is important for, of course, the listenership, our beloved 5%, who all love the sleeper song, The Remembering. It is the Dan Electro 12 is very much present in this side of the album.
So
he didn't have a Rickenbacker at the time. So the Dan Electro 12 was his 12 string of choice for that side of the record. So if I'm not mistaken, I believe that he says in this fine book that I also had images from, he says that he actually took this guitar and tuned it a fifth below. So right. When you're, in actuality, when he's playing an open E, it's actually a low B that you're hearing.
Mm.
Okay. Now he says the overall effect is very pleasing with a very low, murky 12-string sound. It does have some disadvantages. I had to put gaffer tape across the strings behind the bridge to stop them from rattling as it's strung so low.
Yes, I can imagine, yeah.
I always found myself fiddling with the string gauges as well. But plugging into a Marshall, now this is the thing I found fascinating.
Oh, Marshall.
He said, plugging into a Marshall, it sounds incredibly powerful. I haven't used it a great deal, but it does the stab chords in the choruses of Only Time Will Tell from the first Asia album as well.
Right. Yeah.
So I'm fascinated because Steve Howe's always been a Fender user. To hear him say that he used it in a Marshall is like, wow, I didn't even realize that he even used Marshalls in his career.
Yeah. And that reminds me again of those Tormato studio photographs where he has at least six different Fender amps around him as he's recording that album. So yes, fascinating to hear that. But explain to me this 12-string electric guitar thing then. I mean, doesn't it require you to play, and therefore Steve, to play in a very different way, a 12-string rather than a 6-string guitar?
When you first play a 12-string guitar, it does feel rather weird because it's two strings as one, right? Mm. So, and it's always tuned in octaves, well, most of the time, okay? So you have like two E's, two A's, two D's, you know, and it's just a regular string and then a high version of the string underneath it, right?
Mm.
Now, David Bowie made a career out of playing a 12-string acoustic guitar. That was his first guitar he ever had, and it's an old beat-up thing. You always see pictures of him with this 12-string guitar, even on stage. And once you get used to playing it, playing a 6-string again feels so odd because you're so become so used to playing these double-stringed guitars. Mm. You can get very used to it, and it's just as easy as playing a 6-string once you get used to it. It's like anything else. Once you get used to the feel of it and used to playing it, then it's just as easy as playing a 6-string. Now, the thing that's interesting that I've heard some people do, and I think even Steve might have done it, I know Chris Squire did it on his 8-string bass, is sometimes he would tune the two strings in different harmonic notes. Like one, he'll tune like an E and then put like a B underneath it instead of an octave, right? So he'll tune different strings in different pitches, and that can make it really odd sounding if you do it that way, right? But normally you do it in octaves, like so E's, AA, DD, all the way down the neck, right?
Yeah.
So, but the 12 string is something that Steve Howe has used not very often, though. I mean, he's used it on here, obviously, for side two, and it does appear in the Ritual as well.
Yeah, okay. But I'm puzzled by this still a little bit because I'm thinking of those two strings and, you know, vibrating and having to play it in a different way. And, you know, I can't imagine Steve doing his sort of trademark runs up and down the fretboard and finger picking and all those sorts of things. Isn't it more, I mean, whenever I've seen someone playing a 12-string guitar, it's more of a strumming idea. So is that true, or can you also do some pretty intricate stuff on a 12-string?
Well, let's put it this way. I've never seen people like Jimmy Page, Alex Lifeson, John McLaughlin, these people who have been known to have double neck guitars that have a 12-string and a 6-string on there. They've never done it where they're like, look at that amazing solo on the 12-string they're doing. Yeah. Nobody's ever done a solo on a 12-string like that. It is mainly there for those kind of strumming, textural parts, or even doing single note lines. Or even like look at Rush when they do Closer to the Heart. That very beginning of Closer to the Heart is done on a 12-string because it's just that little finger-picked thing with a chord, right?
Yeah. Okay.
And you can do like individual little notes like that, but it's nothing like you can't bend a note.
No,
you can't do like these ripping, shredding things that would just sound ridiculous doing it on 12-string, right?
Yeah.
So it's mainly there for that. And I'm guessing that for the remembering, because if I could remember it all, I'm sure for most of it, it was used in that way where he was playing chords and strumming and it was like textured parts, and where he did the faster bits or the more lead playing, he probably brought out the junior for that.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. And it's fascinating to see an electric 12-string. It's not something I have any experience of myself. Now, that is the end of the electric guitars. But now we go on to the acoustic. So, well, not acoustic, but Spanish guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the one that we know, the one we associate with Steve Howe, is this Kono, I think that's how you pronounce it, isn't it? Kono
yes.
number 10. And that's the one that he bought from a shop in Tokyo on the first Japanese Yes tour in 1973. And he refers to it as his main classical, all of his Spanish guitar work since 1973. But of course, that's not on Tales, because he bought that after recording Tales. So that means he says he thinks he hired a guitar for Tales recording. And clearly, the third side, the ancient, he needed acoustic guitar there. So does this one sound significantly different to you from later on in his Spanish guitar work?
It doesn't sound significantly different. I mean, most of these Spanish or / classical guitars are all nylon stringed, right?
Yeah. Mm.
So they'd have that sort of sound to them right away. You can immediately tell the difference between an acoustic guitar because they're steel string, whereas a classical is nylon stringed.
Yeah.
So you when you hear him playing, you know, Mood for a Day, that's done on a nylon string classical. When you hear him doing the clap, that's acoustic guitar steel string, right?
There's obvious
differences in the tone and how it resonates, especially the high strings.
Yes.
Right? Now, I'm not going to say that all classical sound, I say that would be ignorant to say that, but they do have a similarity in sound. Now, again, this also can go down to a feel, also how the neck is, because some necks are wider, some necks are a bit thicker, some necks have more, there's different woods involved, especially with the tone of the guitar. I mean, I've heard of guitars that have spruce and all kinds of different woods used for it. And sometimes the front of the guitar has different woods than the side and the back of the guitar, right?
Right, okay.
So all these things factor into how a guitar can sound, right?
Yeah, and fascinating that in his guitar book, he says that he spoke to Eddie Offord, doing the recording, the engineering, of course, the producing of this album, and said that he wanted to sound like Julian Bream, who was one of the most famous of the classical guitar players. So he really wanted that, I don't know, complex, intricate sound that Julian Bream got, and he wanted it to sound very much different. So it was a very particular tone he was going for with the third side, particularly the ancient. But another of the acoustic guitars is this Portuguese guitar, which famously was wrongly called a Vocalia, or however you pronounce that, on the Yes album, and is actually called, in reality, a Lord. Although, again, I don't know how to pronounce that. But it's definitely a Portuguese guitar brought back from Portugal for him by his sister, so he says in this book. And you don't need to think too carefully about what this might sound like, because if you think of Wondrous Stories, then that's the Portuguese guitar. That gives it the whole stamp of character of Wondrous Stories. And he also says that he used it on And You and I, and it does appear on side one of Tales and produces some colouring. So is it something you immediately notice on side one of Tales, do you think, this Portuguese guitar?
Let's put it this way. I believe that it's there. I don't notice it nearly as much as you would at, let's say, you know, Wondrous Stories.
Yeah.
Even I've Seen All Good People, Your Move, you know, that has that sort of sound in there as well. And it's interesting, as he says here, the 12 string is also on And You and I. I'm guessing that he did that to double the 12 string. You know, he probably did it that way because I can't hear it on its own, but mixed in with the acoustic guitar, 12 string, it's possible that it's in there, right? But by itself, it's a very identifiable sound. I mean, you know, when you hear it played, you know, you can tell right away that it's that sound. I mean, I remember the first time I heard the Ladder album and it did 9 voices. I was like, hey, he pulled out the Portuguese guitar again. You know, that sticks out like a sore thumb, like, and it in does. A good way, I mean that, you know?
Yes. And he also talks about this, you've already talked about tuning, but very unusual tuning on this guitar, which sounds like he made up this tuning himself just to get the effect that he wanted. Is that why you do different types of tuning?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the one thing I always found interesting about this, is because it says the top strings are tuned to A flat above the guitar, and then it goes E, B, E, B, E, which makes sense, that part, because then that's like an open E tuning, right?
Right, okay,
and
yes.
Then if you watch him playing, you know, good people and stuff like that, he has very, I'm not going to say simple chording, but it's the chording that's very much based around that tuning, yeah. Right? Where he can just play open strumming, two fingers on this position, strum it, two fingers on this. So, it's, you know what I mean? Like, he has like a sort of tuning that's easier to play. I mean, there's a reason why people like Keith Richards play open G or open E slide guitar, because all you have to do on a slide is just bar all the strings with the piece or with one finger, and you have a chord.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's easier than having to finger these things, you know, one finger on the fifth fret, one finger on the seventh.
Yeah.
You just have one fret, you know?
I saw a YouTube video of him doing that recently, or someone explaining how he did that, and that fairly blew my mind, I have to say. but yes, you can get some very, very, some easier ways to make chords and so on by doing different tunings, but I'm sure that's not what the master Steve Howe was going for. He wants a particular effect with it, I'm sure. So yes, and one of the crazy things in this book is an explanation of and some small photographs of this crazy rotating guitar tree that he calls it, which is really a guitar stand that Michael Tate created specifically for the Tales tour. So what was the idea behind this?
Well, you know, when you go into the studio, and especially when you're in a frame of mind like these guys were at that time, where, you know, experimentation was all welcome, let's try whatever we want to get a very fascinating and interesting sound, let's go for something different. You know, Steve found many different guitars, as we just talked about, and he used it on the album. Now here comes the hard part. The album is a success. We're going to go out and play it now. Now he has to recreate this now. He's like, what did I get myself into now? Now I got to bring out a slide. I got to bring out a 12 string. I got to bring out a sitar. I got to bring out my, you know, Les Paul Jr. I got to do, what am I going to do here? So as we all know, we saw before that Steve usually had that lap steel just on a stand that they put there. But now, what's he going to do? He can't have his roadie running back and forth with guitars all day, putting it over his neck and then taking them off. There was sure to be some sort of comical part where somebody trips over a patch cord and he falls, and, you know. So they had to figure out a way to make it logical. And of course, having the great Michael Tate, I believe it is, who was the, inventor extraordinaire.
Yeah.
He put together this fantastical stand called the Circular Tree, where he had on one stand with like, you know, with like a sort of, you know, three legs at the bottom, like a normal mic stand.
Yeah.
And attached to it were three separate arms. On one of the arms had the 12 string, the Dan Electro.
Yes.
On another arm was the sitar.
Mm.
Okay. And then on the middle with another arm had the lap steel slide on there. Now, whenever he needed one of these things, it was just a matter of him going, whoop, turning it to the thing that he needs, and he would play it. You know, now, of course, the one thing he had to make sure is that, and Steve didn't have this problem because he was on stage right most of the time.
Yes.
Is he, you know, could you imagine if he had this in center stage and he turned and he bopped John Anderson in the head, turning it? Oh, I'm sorry, mate. You know, it wouldn't have been good. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. But the funny thing about it, though, is that looking at it now, it looks really odd. And the reason it looks odd is because when you've got the steel guitar in front of you, the other two guitars are at a really crazy angle, aren't they? Because when you have to turn it round, you know, it's a bit like one of those, I don't know if you have them in Canada, I'm sure you do, circular rotating laundry dryers. What am I talking about? Washing dryers.
Yes. Yeah?
It looks like that. But because it's such a thin, I don't know what it is about it, a very, very thin steel rod, which is holding these, they jut out at such odd angles, don't they? I mean, when you're playing one of them, the other two are off in the air, you know.
Yeah.
It looks really odd.
I'm surprised that this thing worked as well as it did, because every engineer will tell you when you're going to do a co-op at the studio, they always tell you when you have a microphone stand that has one of those extended pieces, you know, that like the ones that they could adjust the mic stand further. You know, because you have those old stands that are just straight, and then you have like one of those other ones that have the extended arm on it, right?
Mm.
They always tell you never put the middle, that extended arm, in a position that's not in line with one of the legs, because if you turn it the wrong way, it could tip over.
Right, right? Yes.
How this thing didn't tip over, I have no idea, because the guitars are not light, especially that 12 string.
Yeah.
You know, how did he not turn it, leave it in an odd spot for example? Maybe that's how they designed it, though, so that when one guitar is there, it's always in line with a leg. You know what I mean? So it has that support at the bottom.
Yeah.
Right? Because otherwise it could have just tipped over and then that would have been a pure comedy show.
Yeah.
And I don't know, understand how it wasn't like, you know, this is the 70s, you know, so people might have been, you know, a little under the influence in the audience. I don't know how somebody didn't sit there and start deciding, hey, I'm going to throw my bottle of water at that guitar. Yes, you know, let's see if we can hit it.
Yeah.
You know, it's just asking for trouble to stand, you know?
Yes. I suppose it fitted in with the rest of the stage set, which we're going to come back to in a different episode. And certainly one thing's for sure, it only lasted for one tour. Because after that, they did something completely different. But I just want to finish off, though, by talking about this Line 6 Variax that we talked about before. And this is one of the main reasons that in recent years, he hasn't had to do quite as much guitar swapping. And I did look up the Variax, and one of the things which I knew you could make it sound like different guitars very easily by turning a switch. What I didn't realize, and we've already been talking about the different tunings, is that rather than retuning the strings, just at the press of a button or a turn of a button, you can have different tunings on this guitar, which just, again, I've had my mind blown several times this week. How does that work then? If you just turn a knob and then you've got your strings sounding different, how does it work?
Yeah, I've had the benefit and the pleasure of playing a Variax several times and actually renting one for a session I did a while ago. And they're fantastic. They're absolutely good, but they're excellent at a lot of things, very good at some things, and okay at other things. For example, the sitars are great. They sound really good on there, and it sounds like a sitar. When they start saying that they can model different guitars, like they said, if you switch it to here, you can get a Les Paul sound. If you switch it to this, you can get a Fender Strat sound. That's very good at that too. When it starts doing this other tuning thing, this is where it gets a little shaky sometimes, I find. But like the 12 strings settings are good on this. And I know Steve likes to use that sometimes. I know that he also used on some of the tours the setting for the Martin acoustic guitar where he used the Variax, and that sounds good too. You don't forget, this is another thing that people need to realize. Steve Howe is a devoted Line 6 user. Now, the Variax is made by Line 6. The pedal board that he uses is made by Line 6. Amplifier that he's using is made by Line 6. Now, if he uses a Variax guitar with this stuff, then I can guarantee you it's going to sound a gazillion times better than if you were to buy a Variax and I'm going to plug it into my Fender guitar amp.
Yeah, so it's all works together,
Yeah, it's kind of in unison. When he has that situation going on, it has all this like harmonious technology going for it. Like, because the way that the tuning thing works is that it's a sort of like a technology, like a inside the guitar, like almost like when you buy like a guitar pedal for harmonizing. It'll take your guitar and it'll give you a fifth pitch or a fourth pitch with it. So that kind of technology is inside the guitar.
Yes.
So it can give you different tunings. What it does is it just tells the guitar to output a different pitch for each string.
Yeah. I mean, can you not hear what the strings themselves are producing? I mean, I don't know.
Yeah. That's the thing that makes it difficult.
A bit weird. It sounds a bit weird.
Because if you're not on stage with an amp doing it, and if you're playing it through an amp and it's quiet in your room, for example, then you're going to hear the regular tuning
at the same time.
And that's why it's kind of like, huh? You know? But if you have it on an amp or you have in-ear monitors and you're plugging it in that way, then of course you can hear all of a sudden.
Yeah.
So again, it's all... And I'll put it this way, the technology has definitely bettered along that way where you could have that happening. And don't forget, really quickly, too, Gibson for a while experimented with this sort of technology where they had these robotic tuners on their guitars. And you were able to save like three or four different tunings. So you could tune it like open G or or a DADADA tuning.
Yes.
But people hated it because what would happen is that the minute that it would go slightly out of tune,
yes,
you'd hear the robotic tuners going, and it would start retuning.
Right.
And it would go, yeah, and it was in the middle of your playing, like, what the hell's going on? You'd feel the string moving on you, you know?
Ah, damn. So it wasn't crazy.
It only lasted, like, I think a year or two, and that thing was gone. Nobody liked those tuners.
Well, I think I prefer the guitar tree to that, that's for sure. But the last point I think I want to make about this with the guitar tree is that it shows us once again that Steve was not averse to doing things to his guitars. Because to get these guitars onto the sitar one and the Dan Electro 12 string, they actually had to be cut. So he actually took a saw to these guitars, which presumably now would be, if they were in their original condition, would be extremely valuable. But he was happy to do that, and he tells an amazing story about actually trying to make a double necked guitar with the Dan Electro and the sitar. So to actually put those together, so they took an axe to it again, or not an axe, but a saw to the axe, and doing that kind of thing with it. So he certainly wasn't a purist in those terms, was he?
No, and I'll tell you something. I know collectors, like guitar collectors, that would probably faint. You'd have to get like a respirator out and like paddles and recharge their heart if they heard or saw Steve Howe do this to these guitars.
Yes.
You know, because some of these people are like, you must keep it in original form, you know. And for example, I'm sure you saw that picture of that Gibson Les Paul TV that he had that had those muter things on there. Remember that, those little push things that you could like do like a little almost like a lap steel pitch alteration to the B and E string like that there. That's crazy, okay? Because that means that he had to drill this whole whammy bar kind of system into the guitar.
Yeah.
And as soon as you start doing that, then people are like, oh no, you're devaluing the value of the guitar. But he didn't care about that, you know?
No.
He just did stuff that made his guitar functional for him. Because even in that picture, Kevin, of that Les Paul Jr., the 1955 one, that brown tobacco burst, those tuning pegs that are on there, those are not the original tuning pegs. Those are ones that he put on from another guitar. I think those are even L5 Super 500 tuners.
And they're pretty ugly, I have to say.
Yeah, they are.
They don't look right on the top of that guitar. Oh dear, fantastic stuff. Well, hopefully he won't be sawing up any more of his guitars anytime soon and stick to the Variax, which certainly does the job in a technological way that you couldn't do when he was talking about going out on the road with Tales. But that's been absolutely fascinating. Of course, Mark. And thank you very much indeed for sharing your knowledge and expertise on the guitar side of Tales. I'm sure we'll come back to talking more about the actual lines that he plays. But that on the technical side and on the guitar side has been fantastic. So thank you very much indeed, Mark.
You're very welcome, Kevin.
Yes Music Podcast, 600 episodes.
Just before we go, here are the YMP producers and half the patrons. Yes Music Podcast producers are Joseph Cottrell, Ken Fuller and Jeffrey Caselius. And half of the Yes Music Podcast patrons are Jim Morrison, John Pickles, Declan Logg, Gary Betts, Alan Begg, Michael Handahan, Barry Gorski, Steve Perry, Doug Curran, Martin Kelberg, Todd Dudley, Rachel Hadaway, Lind, Paul Hales, Craig Estenes, Mark James Lang, Steve Rode, David, Bob Martellotta, John Holden, Stephen Lamb, Dem, Fred Barringer, Scott Colombo, Chris Bandini, David Hayden and John Thompson. So thank you very much indeed to all those patrons, as always. If you'd like to join them to help us keep the lights on here at YMP Towers, please do head over to Patreon, patreon.com/YesMusicPodcast, or just click the link on yesmusicpodcast.com. So that is just about all the time we have this week. Thanks so much for listening once again. We hope to be back next week with an interesting interview, so look forward to that. And in the meantime, please do keep listening and getting involved via X, Facebook or Instagram. So until next time, just remember, whatever your progressive rock question, the answer is yes.